There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Ken White, and you're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's legal issues and the legal issues of his lawyers and his lawyers' lawyers and the lawyers suing him. They're complicated, and they bring up really good questions about lying to federal agents and whether or not federal judges yelling at you are really mad or whether they're just like that, and whether or not it's liable for the president to call you a liar on Twitter, and whether or not it's a good idea to try to extort Nike. It was clear that we needed to devote some time every week to answering some of the biggest legal questions surrounding this administration. Now, normally, your redoubtable host, Josh Barrow, from KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, asks those questions, and I answer them based on my background as a federal prosecutor and my current gig as a criminal defense attorney. But this week, Josh is off on a well-deserved vacation someplace fjord intensive, and it's left to me to ask the questions. So who could I call with real experience in the federal criminal justice system? Someone who could really give us insight about how it works and how the media covering the Trump administration gets it right or wrong and what all this means. Well, there was a clear choice, and I'm delighted that she's here. My guest this week is Asha Rangappa. For 5 years, she was Special Agent Asha Rangappa, an FBI agent working counterintelligence investigations. Since then, she's been an associate dean at Yale Law School, a teacher at a variety of prestigious universities, and a senior lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale. She's also a commentator at CNN and a writer of excellent op-eds at The Washington Post and The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. And in general, one of the most reliably clear and well-informed commentators on the subjects most near and dear to our listeners' hearts, the investigations swirling around the Trump administration. Asha, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
As our listeners know, a good part of this show is me grousing about how the media, in covering the Mueller investigation, gets federal criminal law wrong. As a former FBI agent, you must get just as frustrated. What has the media tended to get most wrong about what FBI agents do?
I'd say there's a few things, and some of them are probably ones you've already talked about before. You know, often a lot of people's knowledge is coming from watching Law & Order, and so the speed that they expect things to be resolved is, you know, within 1 hour. And things typically take much longer than that. I will say that because of the popular media conception of you know, how criminal investigations work, I think that they have a general sense of the progression of criminal investigations. And for me, coming at it from a counterintelligence background, and especially with the Trump administration being, you know, involved in a counterintelligence investigation, I think that has been a very steep learning curve for the media in understanding how those work and why they're different than criminal investigations, both in their techniques that they use and in their ultimate goals of the investigations.
Well, let's talk about that. You worked counterintelligence as an FBI agent. What's the difference between working criminal investigations and working counterintelligence?
Well, Ken, as you know, since you were in AUSA, when you are doing a criminal investigation, you start out because you have a suspicion that there has been a violation of federal law. And so your goal is to investigate that, collect evidence of that, and then ultimately, if you get enough to warrant, you know, a prosecution, you'll move forward in the courts. And counterintelligence investigations have nothing to do with the courts. Counterintelligence investigations are about monitoring foreign intelligence activity in the United States. This is the FBI's exclusive jurisdiction. So, for example, the CIA cannot operate in the United States without the permission of the Attorney General, so without working with the FBI. So the FBI has to, A, figure out who the spies are in the country, B, figure out what they're doing, and then C, figure out how to stop them. And those involve completely different methods and tactics and sources, and they very, very rarely see the inside of a courtroom, primarily because most spies are here under diplomatic cover. So they have diplomatic immunity. But even otherwise, you have – these are national security issues. They involve sensitive methods, sensitive sources, and you ultimately don't want your adversary, another country, to know what you know. So you're going to hold your cards very close to your chest. You're not going to give them up. And so it's unlikely that a counterintelligence investigation will translate into a criminal prosecution, though it can happen, and we did see that in the Mueller investigation.
I mean, sure. So in a criminal investigation, the whole point is eventually you're going to have to show your work, right? You're going to indict somebody, and then if it goes to court, if they don't plead guilty immediately, then you're going to have to prove up to a jury what your evidence is. But that's not the case with counterintelligence.
That's right. So in counterintelligence, as I mentioned, once you figure out who the people are and what they're doing, your goal is to neutralize the intelligence service. You want to make whatever they're doing ineffective. And so this can take a number of different forms. Once you're monitoring them, you may just want to monitor them. I mean, this is the goose that's laying the golden eggs, and you learn a lot about how that country operates, how they are using sources. Maybe you're breaking their codes or figuring out how they communicate, what they're interested in. You know, what are their national interests? What are their collection priorities? So you don't want to disrupt that. If you have somebody stealing classified secrets, for example, maybe you'll just start feeding them bad information, or you'll flip the person that is working for the foreign government and you have a double agent who's going back and forth. So it's all of this kind of secret squirrel kind of stuff that you don't want to tip your hand in the way that you do when you go into a criminal courtroom and you have to lay all your cards on the table. And the way that we've seen this play out in the Mueller investigation, one example is, you know, he brought an indictment against 13 Russian nationals and three companies for their social media and disinformation operation in the United States. Now, he didn't expect any of those people to show up in court. I mean, he did that, I think, mainly to expose the operation to the American people. But Russia has decided to challenge this in court, and they have been trying to use the discovery process to figure out how did the FBI get this information. And so this is kind of the trade-off that you want to avoid and which, you know, becomes the decision point when you have a counterintelligence investigation that might involve a violation of federal law.
Well, because the criminal goals of an investigation can conflict with the counterintelligence goals, right?
Correct. Exactly.
So in theory, there's supposed to be a wall of sorts between things gathered in your counterintelligence capacity and things gathered in a criminal investigation capacity. Can you explain that wall and its origins?
Yeah. So again, there's different goals in counterintelligence and in criminal investigations. Counterintelligence is based on the executive branch's national security power, the president's power to, you know, defend the country against, you know, foreign adversaries. And this can conflict with individual rights. And so particularly when it comes to things like electronic surveillance, which is the bread and butter of counterintelligence investigations and often for counterterrorism investigations. And so what the courts had come up with, this is in the 70s, is they said, look, we're not going to create a blanket or we're not going to recognize necessarily a national security exception to the Fourth Amendment or to, you know, other civil liberties. But we recognize that this is something that the executive branch may need to do to protect the country. And so the standards for conducting a counterintelligence investigation and for the techniques that you use in it, for example, electronic surveillance, are lower than they are for criminal investigations. I'm guessing, Ken, as a someone who did public corruption, you probably got Title III's, for example. And those are – Title III's are wiretaps, and my understanding is that the standard is quite high for that. you know, they're high also for counterintelligence, but they're not as specific. They're looser. And so this is recognizing that, you know, you have these different competing interests. And what the courts also articulated in some cases was what we don't want is for the federal government to use these lower standards on the national security side to basically go fishing for dirt on somebody and then bring a criminal case. In other words, we don't want the federal government to be able to use these lower standards that are meant to protect the country to end run the Fourth Amendment and other rights. So the Department of Justice interpreted this as a very strict separation between national security and criminal investigations, the wall. You couldn't share information between the two. And this led to one of the biggest failures during the 9/11 attacks. And I'll quickly explain that, just how it worked. We had Zacharias Moussaoui, the 19th hijacker. He's a French national. There was no clear connection between him and a foreign power. In other words, besides him being a French national, it's not like they could say that he was working for a government or for a terrorist organization. So they really couldn't get these use these techniques on the national security side, which requires that nexus. At the same time, the Department of Justice didn't want to open a criminal investigation because then if they later got some of this, you know, a connection to Al-Qaeda, say, they were afraid the court would say, no, you're just trying to get around the Fourth Amendment. You really want to just prosecute this guy. So they ended up not doing anything. And that was a big failure. So since 9/11, that wall has been dismantled, both statutorily and jurisprudentially. But even so, I think that there is some hesitation to kind of share widely. I think only in the most serious cases, in terrorism cases, will they do it. And, you know, they still generally recognize that these are two different, fundamentally different kinds of investigations with different goals.
So in theory, still, the government shouldn't be using the lower standards or easier standards from the counterintelligence side to gather information to then use in a criminal case. And I mean, courts are still going to apply regular Fourth Amendment standards to evidence that was gathered and not just let you use it willy-nilly just because you happen to be looking for spies when you gathered it.
Right. I mean, I think there's a recognition that, you know, a case isn't going to be strictly counterintelligence or counterterrorism and strictly criminal. I mean, there is this blurry line. And I think, but at the same time, as you mentioned, you know, prosecutors and the FBI don't have an interest in having their credibility eroded in courts by kind of abusing the dismantling of the wall by going after people, you know, and on very small things that they've crossed over. And so, you know, you mentioned an experience, Ken, and you can probably repeat it about how, you know, you hit this wall, and criminal agents often do that. Even if there is information relevant to their cases that are on the national security side, they can get it, but you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get it because that information is often classified, and because revealing it could compromise an ongoing national security investigation. So, you know, it's not easy, even though the wall technically isn't there.
Well, sure. And the story you're referring to was in the 1990s, and I had a smallish anti-terrorism case as a federal prosecutor, and they told me there was a piece of information I'd need to get a higher clearance to get because it was counterintelligence. So I went through 6 months of jumping through hoops to get a higher security clearance, and the single piece of information they gave me was basically to the extent of saying, the guy you think is named Jimmy Joe Bob is actually named Joe Jimmy Bob. So it was not terribly useful, but it reflected how at the time, how seriously they took that. You know, defense attorneys would say generally that, particularly with the Patriot Act and other things like that since 9/11, that a lot of the measures that have been sold as having to do with national security and warding off another 9/11 actually wind up being used in run-of-the-mill criminal cases, that a lot of the tools and methods and rules wind up getting used to take down drug dealers instead of, you know, the next Al-Qaeda. But, you know, we're defense attorneys. We're going to make arguments like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely they have dismantled that wall. So, you know, what used to be, you know, this barrier is not there. I think the extent to which that is now that information flows, I think, is debatable.
So the Mueller report, which we've covered in gratuitous detail on this show, definitely talked a lot about the criminal investigation and the criminal evidence, but it merely alluded to the counterintelligence side. Based on your experience, what do you infer from what might still be ongoing in terms of a counterintelligence investigation surrounding the types of things Mueller was looking into?
You know, one of the things that I think people need to understand is counterintelligence investigations first begin with identifying what the foreign government is doing. So you start with the Russians and then, you know, you're seeing who they're contacting and then you start investigating them and, you know, you're building out this network. Maybe in that sense it's more like, say, organized crime. The Mueller report was clearly a report that was by the book under the regulations. And under the regulations, he was required to produce a report that lays out his prosecutorial and declination decisions in the course of his investigation, which means that it was really focused on the criminal investigations that came out of, you know, the Russia probe. But we know that Russia is continuing its interference operations, its disinformation operations. So clearly the FBI is still investigating that. And there may be subjects that they, you know, began looking into during the course of the, you know, 2016 interference election that are still ongoing because of the things that I mentioned earlier. Maybe they are continuing to get intelligence from those investigations. Maybe they have created new sources from those investigations, double agents. I mean, we don't know. And as a result, you know, not only would those not have appeared in the Mueller report, but that would be something that is ongoing. And I'll add here, we know that there was actually a counterintelligence investigation opened on President Trump and in May of 2017. And as far as I'm aware, there's been no confirmation that that was ever closed. So I think it's a question of whether even that specific investigation is ongoing. And I think one of the frustrating parts is that we may not see the results of that investigation because of, you know, we can't expose, you know, if the CIA has sources in Russia, for example, or if our allies are giving us intelligence that is helping facilitate those investigations, that's not ever going to be something that's revealed in a public report. But in my opinion, those would all be, you know, ongoing things because we need to figure out what Russia is up to even as we speak.
Well, no big deal. A counterintelligence investigation of the President of the United States. Just something I would normally associate with a book I pick up at the airport before boarding a plane. But I guess it's all good. Before we take a break, here's a preview of something new coming soon. We'll have more to say when Josh is back next week. But here's what I can say now. We listened to all of your suggestions for all the President's Lawyers merch. All of them. And let me just say, some of you people have issues. But the first item we're releasing is really f***ing cool. More next week. When we come back, we'll talk about whether you should talk to the FBI. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Ken White, and I'm back with former FBI agent, university lecturer, and commentator Asha Rangappa on All the President's Lawyers. Asha, another favorite thing we do on this show is grouse about clients. Really, that's just one of my favorite things to do, period, but people have to listen to me when I do it on the show. One of the things I complain about is that clients talk to law enforcement without first checking with their lawyers. Now, you were an FBI agent. You clearly don't think that FBI agents are bad. But let me ask you something. If someone you cared about came to you and said, hey, the FBI called, they want to talk to me about a transaction I helped with last year, should I talk to him? What would you say?
I would say, Ken, that it really depends on the context of the the request. I mean, if the FBI is wanting to ask someone about something they did, I would advise them to talk to a lawyer. If they are really doing an investigation about something else and they're trying to get, you know, to, what do you know about your neighbor? I mean, they're investigating your neighbor and, you know, they're trying to get information. Did you see him leave the house? You know, whatever. I don't know that someone needs to retain a lawyer for that. You know, they are really providing just factual information for the course of an investigation on someone else. So that's kind of the distinction that I would make. You know, I do think that the FBI relies on people to be, you know, to provide them with information. Obviously, though, if they are looking into your activities, they are looking into your activities and they may be trying to get evidence. So that's where I would make that distinction. What do you think?
Fair enough. And that's pushback that I get all the time from my message that you should talk to your lawyer immediately when the government wants to talk to you. And what I tell people is that you may not be trained as a layperson to tell the difference from when a professional is genuinely asking about your neighbor or actually asking about you. Is it fair to say that FBI agents are trained to get people to talk when they really shouldn't?
FBI agents are trained to establish rapport and elicit as much information as they can from the person that they are speaking with. You know, I think if you're concerned, you can always ask the agent, am I under investigation? They can't lie to you about that. But yes, I mean, they are trained to talk to you to basically get you to barf out as much information as you're willing to provide. That obviously makes their job a lot easier. I will say that, you know, I encounter, you know, my interviews with people were happening in a much different context. And we already talked about the difference between counterintelligence and criminal investigations. When I was talking to people, I wasn't doing a criminal investigation. And I typically didn't have anything to hold over these people's heads, right? You know, I was sometimes talking to scientists and researchers or people who are working in companies because I'm trying to figure out, you know, what an ex-spy is doing. You know, so in my case, I felt almost more reliant on their goodwill and willingness to provide information. And I think that there was a very low risk for those people, unless they lied, to, you know, get into any kind of trouble with me.
Well, and I mean, there are plenty of jobs, plenty of professions where building a rapport and getting people to open up and talk is part of the game plan. You know, it could be something as run-of-the-mill as sales, all sorts of things. But it's definitely a particular skill. Why do you think people tend to be so willing, almost eager, to talk to agents who or any law enforcement who might be investigating something they did wrong? Is that something you kind of in the course of your training and experience and observation of how law enforcement works in America, is that something you have a sense of?
Yeah, I think people often want to explain themselves. And also people like to hear themselves talk. So that's actually, you know, one thing you can count on as an agent is if you ask a question, you just allow there to be some silences, people are kind of programmed to fill that silence. And they will, you know, start volunteering information. The FBI also teaches a technique called RPM. And this stands for rationalize, project, and minimize. And so the idea is if you're actually talking with someone who you think might, you know, be involved in something that they've done wrong, that you can elicit information by getting on their side, by first helping them rationalize, you know, what they did. You know, it's not it would make sense that you would have, you know, shredded all those documents, you know, when you thought that, you know, whatever, you found out that this had happened. You know, a lot of people might do that, and then people want to agree, and so they'll kind of go along with it. And then you can project. You then kind of shift the blame, you know, on someone else. And again, people want to do that. They don't want to take the responsibility themselves and then minimize, as you just say, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And so that, like, you're kind of helping this person along in this process of talking through what they did, almost the way that they might if they are going through it in their own mind and trying to not acknowledge their responsibility in it.
So this is one of the few things that popular entertainment gets not too wrong, right? This is the classic cop show moment where the cop is telling the suspect, yeah, I understand you got upset. Who wouldn't get upset? You know,
right.
That person was treating mm-hmm. you unfairly. Just, you know, you must have been furious. I can just imagine. And like, so that is real. I mean, that part is not completely made up.
No, I think it's just basic psychology. You know, people who feel tremendous amounts of guilt. I mean, unless you're a sociopath, you are typically you are seeking someone to help you go through this process, to help you rationalize it, to help you feel like, you know, this wasn't, you know, you weren't crazy to do this. And so if someone outside comes in and walks you through that, it can be incredibly, it can feel like a relief to this person. And then they give you the information. So no, I don't think it's inaccurate. And I think it's really taking advantage of basic psychology, which is why you would want a lawyer there, because a lawyer would tell you to shut up and not answer the questions.
You know, one of our favorite stories over the last year has been when former General Michael Flynn got yelled at by a federal judge, basically for pushing the idea that it was the FBI's fault that he was charged with false statements, because when they interviewed him in the White House, they didn't tell him, by the way, lying to us is a federal crime and you should not lie. Asha, is that a thing? Do FBI agents warn people don't lie to us before they start to have a conversation?
You know, I did. And I did that because, like I said, in most of my interviews, I didn't have anything on that person. I really needed information from them. And sometimes I knew they had information and they didn't have to talk to me. They could have slammed the door in my face, and sometimes they did. But, you know, and I learned this from my partner. We would say, look, you know, the only thing you can get in trouble for here is if you lie. And Martha Stewart had actually just been arrested. And she had been booked, like, while I was there in my first, you know, year in New York. And we'd use her as an example. You know, Martha Stewart wasn't, you know, she didn't go to jail for obstructing justice. She went to jail for lying. And so that was something that I would say. I probably wouldn't say it if I was interviewing someone who was a subject of the investigation, I might not. I'd probably play dumb. And I do, you know, I think a lot of, you know, you might see agents do kind of the country bumpkin, you know, wow, you know, what's going on? We just came across this. It's really puzzling. Can you help us out? And then let the person fill in the blanks. They're probably not going to announce it. And Michael Flynn knew better.
Of course he did. And yes, thank goodness for the whole Mueller investigation, because the Martha Stewart thing is just too old. When I have millennial clients, they just look at me with a blank stare. But now I can use stuff that's in the news right now to explain why you shouldn't lie to the FBI or to anyone else.
And Ken, I mean, just to add, like right there, I think George Papadopoulos would have been was a good example of this. I mean, they interviewed him, as far as I can tell, in the course of a counterintelligence investigation. They are trying to get information to, you know, verify the intelligence that the Australian government had given, that he had, you know, said that he had been approached with, you know, dirt on Hillary. All he had to do was just tell the truth. He was not going to get in trouble for that, but he chose to lie. And so I think that's a case. And, I suspect they may have warned him in that case, too. But, you know, he did it anyway.
He fell for the Columbo. He fell for the, we're just asking things here.
One more thing. Yeah.
Just one more thing. Well, thank you so much. There's so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Asha Rangappa, thank you so much for speaking with me. I hope our listeners will watch out for your commentary and your op-eds, because they're great. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ken.
If you all have questions about the president's lawyers and his lawyers' lawyers and the lawyers suing them and their legal issues, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. Or you can also leave us a voicemail at 310-853-3514. All of the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Ken White. Thanks for joining us, and Josh and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.